I wasn't invited to the wedding. Since I wasn't invited, I didn't go. I might have gone if I had been invited, if only to see Elton John. I don't know why I wasn't invited. I love England. I spent 3 years there at the London School of Economics, and those were among the best years of my life. I found myself there. The British opened my eyes to a new world, a world of fierce intellect and free thinking that is still with me 30 years later. I even took part of Britain back home with me. At university, I fell in love with an English rose who would become my wife. I'm in good company of the Dist. Tony Blair wasn't invited. Gordon Brown wasn't invited. Barack Obama wasn't invited, so I'm not really too offended. On the other hand, the King of Swaziland was invited. The royal families of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia were invited, and these are not exactly the role models of the British invented parliamentary democracy idea or the liberty espoused and envisioned by John Stuart Mill. Since I'm not a tyrant and I have good British credentials, I thought that maybe they would send me an invitation. Actually, a bar mitzvah invitation that I recently received from one of our congregants momentarily took my breath away because I thought I recognized there the royal insignia. After all, I consider myself an honorary Cockney. I lived in my 3 years back in the early 80s at the Hillel House in Stepney Green in the East End of London, a mile from Bow Bells. And according to British tradition, if you were born within a mile of Bow Bells, you're a Cockney. Maybe that was the reason I wasn't invited. Cockneys aren't exactly royal material. He could get away with marrying a commoner for the first time in 350 years, but try bringing home a Cockney girl to the Queen Mother. I don't think so. How shall I say this? The Cockneys don't speak the Queen's English, and they like fish and chips. Or maybe I wasn't invited because of that Hillel House thing. You know, the Brits have complicated views about us people. Had I been invited, I might have been better able to understand the excitement of the royal wedding. Had I not been stiffed, maybe I would have gotten more into the swing of things. Do you know that there are some people that woke up at 5 this morning to watch the royal wedding? I know this firsthand. One of the really fascinating aspects of bringing home part of England with you is to witness this amazingly raw and unrestrained British skepticism and ferocious cynicism about practically all things, combined with a unique British patriotism that centers around the royal family and brooks no criticism of the Queen. The British media and the British people verbally assault any political and social phenomenon that raises their ire. They can find fault in the smallest details that, frankly, other people don't even notice. But give them a royal wedding, and all of their suppressed, introverted patriotism comes gushing out. And they seem to lose that very British cynicism that we so love about them, and which makes them so British. At 5 a.m. this morning, I awoke to the sounds of predictions about who designed the wedding gown and what it would look like in reverential tones that other nations reserve for patriotic wars, or say, a moon landing. I certainly understand the celebrations and patriotic energies released by a presidential inaugural or the election of a new prime minister, but the British royal family has no real political power. It would be one thing if the prince had the power to decree, off with his head. like his predecessors long, long ago. But the queen has no real constitutional authority. I mean, there is some. This is one of the chapters that they teach you in British constitutional law school universities, but these powers are only theoretical. If the queen were to actually use them at her discretion, the British Parliament would take them away within a week. I don't begrudge the Brits this moment of national pride. If they want it, gesundheit, which is a phrase that us people use to mean, go ahead, fine, causes no harm. But apparently something like 2 billion people tuned in. Why? It's not real. It's a fantasy. Make believe. So what gives? I give credence to this notion that the world is such a violent, unsettling, and mixed up place now that people readily embrace one brief moment of respite and escape. Give us something good to distract us before we need to pay the mortgage or fill up the gas tank again. But in my mind, it goes deeper than that. One of the unfortunate byproducts of the 21st century is that so much of our trust in institutions has evaporated. No one can solve the economic problems. To the contrary, elected leaders behave like children fighting for space in the sandbox. We don't trust government anymore. Revolutions are sweeping the world, and people know deep down that revolutions release revolutionary energy that nobody can predict or control. We don't trust the church anymore. We don't trust religious authorities anymore. We don't trust schools anymore. We don't trust teachers anymore. We don't trust doctors anymore. We don't trust judges anymore. We don't trust corporations anymore. We don't trust financial advisors anymore. We don't even trust baseball players or bicycle riders anymore. This, I think, is behind much of the sentiment expressed by billions of people who simply want to be left alone to enjoy the escapism of a royal wedding. It's precisely because the royals have no power. It is precisely because the wedding means nothing. It's just a nice event that people can vest in these figures all of our hopes for personal happiness and a fairy tale ending. Proper to remind ourselves of the Jewish point of view, and I raise it not to be a killjoy. Go ahead, wake up at 4 in the morning and enjoy the pomp and the circumstance of the day. That's fine. Really, that's fine. I don't care. But you know, some of us needed to prepare a sermon today. So it seems that it's just a good day to reflect on how Judaism looks at all of this. This week's Torah portion is Parshat Kedoshim in the book of Leviticus. It contains perhaps the best known of all of the biblical verses. Ve'ahavta l're'echa kamocha. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Judaism, unlike other religious approaches, did not consider this to be an emotional statement. We did not interpret love as love in your heart. Love meant action. It meant treat people as you would want to be treated. It is action. It is the deeds that count in Judaism. Love your neighbor as yourself meant these are your behavioral obligations to the people around you and to society at large. You are not allowed to withdraw into fantasy. You are not allowed to retreat into your own fairy tale world. It is not enough simply to feel. In truth, human beings have a limited capacity to sympathize with the hardships of others. We cannot emotionally love our neighbors as ourselves. That's impossible. Some 300 fellow Americans died yesterday in catastrophic tornadoes that swept across the Midwest, and yet the royal wedding saturated the news and dominates our attention. And so Judaism insisted that love meant action, personal and collective responsibilities. And this is hard. Democracy is hard. Personal responsibility is hard. Collective responsibility is hard. Governing is hard. Making a living is hard. I think that many people, deep down, even those who live in democracies, I think that many people, deep down, actually would like a king to rule and to take some of the responsibilities off of us. But here's the rub. As long as the king is benign, no one wants to be oppressed. But if the king is a gentle king, kind of like Queen Elizabeth, she's harmless enough, then I think that many people would like that. Leaving aside that this sentiment, too, is a fantasy. As another famous Brit said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The reason that Queen Elizabeth is considered cute and cuddly and lovable to so many is that she has no real power. We have a bit of that fantasy going on in Judaism too, a bit. We yearn for a Messiah, which we understood not in the Christian way, not in the form of a second coming of God in human form, but simply the anointing of a king of flesh and blood, a political figure, who will unite the entire world and bring about a peaceful coexistence. This is about as much as we allowed ourselves to fantasize in Judaism. And even that fantasy was severely limited. The Messianic era, ushered in by a political figure, specifically stated in the tradition, a descendant of the family of King David, would happen. We could dream about it, but it would always be in the future, far, far into the future. Judaism's messianic era never came, and hence there could never be a second coming because there wasn't a first time. The messianic era was always in days to come. It is one of the secrets of Judaism's optimism and faith in humanity, because in the meantime, while we were waiting, we have to act to improve the world by assuming personal and collective responsibility and exercising personal and collective empowerment. Judaism believed that we could not simply wait, sit back, and wait for the second coming of the king. We would continue to work to create daily conditions that would usher in a messianic era of peace and tranquility, and it was our actions that would determine whether and if the messianic era would arise. And in the meantime, we were skeptical of those who believed in fantasies. According to Jewish lore, the question is asked, what should you do if in the middle of planting your vineyard, the villagers start shouting, the Messiah is coming, the Messiah is coming? Finish planting the vineyard, we were urged, and then go out and check the news of the Messiah if you really must. And finally, let me offer this. Every wedding is a bit of a fantasy, because every wedding marks the triumph of a sort of messianic hope for one brief shining moment. We know that after the honeymoon, we get back to real life with all of its problems and with all of its complexities. But a wedding represents hope and potential. It's why people cry at weddings. Weddings are occasions when we are struck by the awesome and terrible bargain that life arranges for human beings. Potential and unrealized potential. Success and failure. Joy and sadness. Promise and unattainability. the limitlessness and limitations of life. At weddings, it dawns on us how fragile we really are. Even the sight of the bride represents only a fleeting moment of joy. People cry at weddings not simply because they are happy. At the heart of every joy is the pinch of destiny, the knowledge of our creeping mortality. Life is fragile. Life is fleeting. The sages urged us to regard the sight of the bride as a moment when we acquire true humility, the recognition and ultimate acceptance of our smallness, vulnerability, and fragility. But our tradition also urges us to consider life a good and a great gift. Look at the bride and rejoice in the flowering of our full potential, drinking in the sweet nectar of our brief days in the sun. How sweet is the light, and what a delight for the eyes to behold the sun.